Hello, everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. It's true. They're the same activity. Just take different shape. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we're funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA and their fabulous yearly conference, which takes place in July here in the SeaTac area of Seattle. You can go to PNWA.org, sign up now. That conference is already filling up. Amazing. I should say also, now this is kind of late in the game, but I think we still have some spots left. I will be teaching a memoir class through the PNWA starting this Thursday, February 4th. It's just a 5-week class. And so this is if you're interested in memoir, interested in writing in general, but memoir in particular, I'll be teaching it on Thursday evenings once a week for 5 weeks. I think I still have some spots open. So if you go to PNWA.org, you can sign up for that. And I should also mention that next week I'll be in a couple places. If you are a member, if you're up in Bellingham, Washington, I'll be talking to the Whatcom Writers Association up in Bellingham on the 10th, on Wednesday, February 10th, the evening of their weekly or monthly meeting. And I'll be teaching an all-day class through the Whidbey Island Writers on Saturday, February 13th, over there on Whidbey Island. This is an all-day craft and confidence masterclass through the Whidbey Island Writers Association. Go to Whidbey Island Writers Association and find out about that, or my website, williamknauer.com, that gives you information about that. That's a great all-day class. All right. Well, listen, if you like suspense fiction, I probably don't need to introduce today's guest, Lisa Gardner. She has got over 22 million books in print. Lisa's books have been published in 30 countries. Four of her novels have found their way to the small screen, At the Midnight Hour, The Perfect Husband, Survivor's Club, Hyde, all been made into movies. And she has won awards from both the International Thriller Writers of the United States and from RWA, that's Romance Writers of America. She has Lisa has got an interesting problem. She's got so many books, she has lost track of how many she's published. Well, I counted, and according to my records, her latest, Find Her, is her 18th novel. That's not even including short fiction. Oh, my God. Lisa, how do you do it? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing just fine, Bill. It's like, why? Now you have me obsessed with counting. How many have
been? You know, I have to say, so I haven't published 18 books, but I was giving a I'm sure you've gone through something similar. I was giving a keynote address once, and the woman, you know, introduced me. And so I do kind of inspirational stuff. And so she read this thing that I had written because she had found it inspiring. And I thought, oh, I wrote that? Well, that was awfully good.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure that, you know, I think it's a good thing to forget how many books you've written because you're on to the next one, right?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the fun things for me this time of year is I'm on here with you to get to talk about Find Her, which will be available Tuesday, February 9th. But in fact, I'm getting up each morning and I am writing the 2017 novel. So I have to switch gears now and think, what did I do last year? What book are we talking about?
So that's an interesting question. So you're a book a year, I assume.
Yes, I am.
Okay. So what is your schedule? I mean, there's your daily schedule, but what is your general schedule for finishing a book in a year? How do you hope to accomplish that?
Yeah. Well, at this stage of my life, I am a working mom. So like a lot of parents, I somewhat follow the school calendar. Basically,
right.
By September, I want to be starting a book. And for me, because I'm a suspense novelist and I use a lot of forensics, police procedure, the first few months are going to be research. I might visit something like the Writers Police Academy, which figures into Find Her. I reached out to the FBI, which for the record takes about 3 months to get an interview with in this day and age.
Oh,
so I can talk to their Office of Victim Assistance, you know, kind of lined up everything I need to learn, did all my interviews. And by January, I want to be writing. And basically, my daughter's last day of school is when I want to have a draft of the book done in June. So Finder took about 6 months to draft. And then I am a seat of my pants writer, people call it. I don't know the ending. I'm writing to get there. And I do think the one weakness with that model is you do need to do revision work. Once you finally figure it all out and you reach the end, you need to go back and make it all make sense. So that becomes the summer. And then in September, I start the whole process all over again.
Wow. Okay. And then, and so do you, when you do your first draft, do you send that to your editor or do you say, no, no, I'm going to do what I know I need to do before I let them look at it?
Actually, I work with an amazing editor, so I definitely send him. I work with two of them, my British and my U.S. editor. Let them beat it up, because I'll see things, but they're not as close to it as I am, and their vision is generally clear, and it saves me a lot of time versus me. Not sure, something right about here is maybe not, and they're just like, you need to do this. Like, oh, you're right. That's okay.
And you trust
that
them.
That was it.
And you trust their guidance in that. All right, so you say you have to start again. So you're ready to start one in September. But you must have, before you do research, I assume you've got some inkling of what the story is going to be, of who your character is and what's going to happen. I mean, what the general thrust of the story is.
I think one of the fun things about being a novelist is we can do things like, you know, waste time surfing the internet and it still works. Most of my books have started with something I read online. In the case of Finder, I had read an article written on the FBI.gov website on a hostage negotiator, essentially this new position they're working on, the Office of Victim Assistance, where they have psychologists coming in and working with the families of the victims as well as the victims themselves for these long-term either abduction or kidnapping cases. And it can be anything from, you know, the oil businessman that was taken, kidnapped for ransom in Nigeria to like the Ohio kidnapping, Columbus kidnapping, where you have three people who are held for over 10 years. How do you get them integrated back into society? How do you... you know, really move the families forward. And so it was reading an article like that, and that was like 2 years ago, that kind of put it in the back of my head, you know, this is something I want to deal with. I was fascinated by this notion. I think authors, you know, we get intrigued by questions. And in suspense, we've always had this structure in the genre where, you know, you identify who did it, the butler with a candlestick in the library.
Right.
And that's
the
end. And it's so interesting to read these real-life cases now where that's not the end at all. It's just the beginning of a whole new story. And that's what kind of fascinated me several years ago. And then it was just kind of churning it over, thinking about it, gathering other research pieces. And then last year I wrote the book.
You're turning over what happens to the one who was kidnapped, how it keeps going and going and going afterwards.
And what do you want to do with that or say with that? And I think for me, one of the things when I started, then I went and I read a lot of nonfiction in addition to fiction. I think writers should always read within their genre, but you should read outside your genre too. It will expose you to other styles. It will expose you to more ideas. So I read a lot of nonfiction or memoir accounts of some of these people who were kidnapped and held for long periods of time. And the thing that struck me reading all of them is, you know, again, we have this fictional construct of before and after, or something bad happened and then it was happily ever after. Where to read these accounts, it's much more journey. There's the person you were and the life you were leading, and then this huge traumatic interruption. And when the dust settles, you don't go back to before.
No.
You have to find your way to a whole new you and a new life and a new dream. And there's examples like Elizabeth Smart, who did a phenomenal job with that. And then there's, you know, other examples of where it's a work in progress. So I had to kind of think through, if I'm going to tell the story as an author, what is it that's fascinating for me? And I think it's that notion of the survivor. What makes a survivor? How do you be a survivor? How do you know when you've succeeded I forgot. Or is it just always a question?
Well, yes, because of course, if you don't, at some point, you have to say it's over. I mean, obviously, physically, it's over. But if you want your life back, your life is not, I mean, as I would think, as anybody with a powerful imagination knows, your life is not necessarily where you are, but what you think about where you are. And your thoughts are far more determine your experience probably than your environment. And so the victim, she's free or he's free, but is he really at that point? Does he feel
one
safe?
One of the things I found so intriguing when I was talking to the psychologist with the FBI is that when you are in a dire circumstance, whether it is war, whether it is, a really bad family situation, or for the sake of my novel, say, an abduction situation, there's a tendency to romanticize the future. If I just get out of here, you know, I'll never be unhappy again. If I just survive this, I will never take real life for granted. But the truth is, that's trying to swap one artificial state for another. And
that's
like
right.
People come home and there's definitely a bubble, a honeymoon period. I am free. I am seeing my loved ones. I am eating brownies. You know, it's just all the stuff. I see my cat. Everything I told myself I wanted. But you can't sustain the high any more than you could endure the low. Real life just starts to happen. And how much then that starts to trip up even the best coping person. I'm free and I'm still unhappy. Oh my God, it happened to me.
Yeah, you know what that reminds me of? Is you hear about, say, speaking to my artist listeners, many of whom are writers in the arts world, it's not unusual to have an artist achieve a kind of phenomenal success and then kill themselves. It happens. There's enough of these, or either drink themselves to death or drug themselves to death.
Yeah.
And I think that in part that is, you know, if you achieve it on a tremendous level, there is the fantasy when you're struggling along. If I could just have X, Y, and Z, how will I'll never be unhappy. And lo and behold, that's not the case. And I can easily see you thinking, well, where is it going to come from? If I've got all this and still, you know, it doesn't solve all the problems. It's the flip side of that same thing.
The fundamental issue, you can't externalize your happiness. High functioning people know how to find it on the inside and find a ray of it even in the darkest situations. But
absolutely.
You know, all I am is a fiction writer, but these larger concepts have always fascinated me. And I love the psychology of crime, and more with the research I'm doing, that's the stuff I'm trying to understand. Not just, you know, what's the nature of evil that makes, you know, these super predators, it feels like they're on the nightly news on a daily basis at this point. These extraordinary stories of survival, of people who've really been through the worst and then gone on to lead triumphant lives.
Yeah. Well, it's inspiring, I think, to us, because I don't want to live my life thinking that some event will come along and I'll never be happy again. Like that, there's some Rubicon I might cross from which I'll never return, you know. And so when you can tell a story of someone undergoing tremendous physical or emotional suffering and to return to a sense of themselves, I think it's inspiring because I think that's
one of the reasons we gravitate to suspense. Some people say, well, you know, they're such dark books. But I think what we are reading for and what a suspense novelist is trying to provide is that triumph, that good versus evil, and good historically has always found a way. And this is just a fictional protocol to help us, you know, have some vicarious enjoyment at night. But it harkens back to that larger, you know, moral victory of bad things do happen in the real world, and there are real survivors too, and there are real heroes out there too. And that's what brings us back to this, you know, this archetype again and again and again.
Well, but for the dark, the light would not be as discernible. It's absolutely true. The contrast of the darkness, I teach my students this all the time. I say contrast is your friend. If you want to show the light of hope, you must contrast it against darkness. You'll see it better. You turn on a flashlight in the middle of the day, it means nothing. And so you need
that
intense.
Like
that. Right, but that's really what it is. you know, if you want to write a book about war, about peace, you better show me war, because I won't understand the peace. If you want to write about love, you better show me anger. You better show me loneliness, or I won't understand it. Does that make sense?
I mean, certainly one of the biggest challenges I had writing a book like Find Her is I'm reading all these accounts of, you know, these young girls that are abducted, that have been held, you know, in kidnapping situations for, in some cases, decades. You know, as a mother, this is everything, you know, of course, that is terrifying to a parent. And yet the whole point in reading them is, and they survived, and the human spirit took over. And it is amazing what, you know, everyday average people really can accomplish. And you have to kind of keep that in your mind to do the research, or it would be incredibly difficult to do.
Yes, that's just what I was thinking about, Lisa, because I was reading this book, and I will tell you, I don't normally read anything scary. I can't watch scary movies. I can't, but this is my job. And so I was reading your book, and I won't give away much about this book, but it begins in a box, and I had to put it down, and then I picked it up. But I had to put it because it so creeped me out. I'm a little claustrophobic. So you did a great job of portraying that. Congratulations. But I thought, Jesus, God, how does she do this? This is, I mean, you've got to keep your, you don't want to depress yourself. You don't want to freak yourself out, but you want to make it realistic. You want to make it compelling. You want to make it real and tactile. So how do you keep your buoyancy? You're such a happy little spirit. How do you do that when you're writing about these very dark experiences?
We all have our ways of working through our fears, I guess. And one of the things for me is I am claustrophobic. So that's almost exactly why you have a poor girl trapped in a box. Yeah. Because, you know, something is terrifying to me. I figure it must scare other people too. And I really did, honest to God, have a day where I laid on the floor of my office. I called it method writing. It was kind of funny. I carved out what would be a reasonable shape of a box. I made myself, and I'm like, okay, what would you do? And it was interesting if he tried to focus being in that tiny space. And I got this from reading some of the memoirs, too, that one of the single biggest stressors of captivity is boredom. We don't realize how much input and stimulation we all get all the time until it's gone. And, like, you know, some of the girls, you know, the captors eventually brought them radios, and they, like, wept with joy just to finally have stimulation. So, well, that would be... Pain would be one of your issues. It's uncomfortable laying a wooden box. But stimulation, you would need to find ways to stimulate yourself or you would go insane. So what can you do?
Yes.
And I love that part of writing. It's all these hypothetical questions. What would you do? What would you do? What would you do? And, you know, you're rooting for the character, and the character's whole point is she's coming up with some pretty decent problem solving. I mean, they're not great. They're not what you want to do all day long, but if these are the only choices you have, you know?
You know, it reminds me, I saw, it's a really nice little interview that John Irving did with Stephen Colbert on his new show. You know, he likes to have writers on, God bless him. And Irving described his method of coming up with a story as he creates a character he loves. He finds a character he loves and then imagines the worst possible thing that could happen to them. I thought that's really kind of what a writer has to do, because you don't want to imagine the best thing that could happen to them. There'd be no story. And you would never do that with your own children. What's the worst thing that could happen to my child? I sure hope that happens to them. But that's really what you need for your characters.
But it's interesting. I sure hope such and such the characters in your next book, because I love them. And I'm like, you do understand what you're subjecting them to then.
But they know they're going to be okay. I think that if I were a suspense writer, if I were to take that on, I would have to maintain my belief in the ultimate power of good. I would have to write towards that. Even though I was writing about violence and murder, I would have to ultimately keep my eye trained on humanity's inherent goodness.
That's what I think. I do think that's what suspense is always about. I mean, writers like me are considered some of the darker writers. But it's like you were saying in the beginning, you're only having the dark so you can find the light. We don't want to read depressing things at the end of the day. We want to read about triumph. We want to read about strength. We want to read about fortitude. And I do think, at least for me, the books are often problem solving. It's a detective, you know, trying to solve breadcrumbs. It is someone in a treacherous situation, you know, fighting to get back to the light of day. One of the things I liked about Find Her that was poignant for me, and it was not planned, but again, it came out of reading people's stories, was trying to show the larger family picture. And Flora was the one kidnapped, but her whole family was victimized. I mean, her mom had to quit her job because in this day and age, you have to run social media campaigns for your missing child. You have to appear on cable news shows. You have to appear on morning shows. I mean, normal, everyday people who got up one morning, their lives have just changed.
Yeah.
And after all of that, her daughter comes home, and she's not the girl she used to be. You know, there's this big shift that the entire family is trying to work their way through. And that, to me, was interesting to explore and write after all of these more kind of linear books we all do. Where, okay, you know, person's kidnapped, person's found, happily ever after, case closed, all done.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me, I write a lot about my relationship to my son, who was diagnosed with autism when he was young. And what I found about that, whenever I heard adults talking about autism, it occurred to me they were always talking about themselves. Even if they were talking about the child, they were talking about themselves because their fear for the child, whether the child would end up living what we consider a more or less traditional life, was the fear for themselves. And so that, when I wrote about him, he reminded me of a child abducted. I will never be happy until he's back, until I know he's going to be okay. And it had the same kind of permeating effect, I think, on a family in a strange way that a missing child would, because you don't know as a parent if you're allowed to be happy if that child isn't totally safe, which a disease, which it really isn't. I wouldn't call autism that, but that expression can bring about those same thoughts. That makes sense?
Well, it's that phenomenon of changing your expectations. You had a dream of being a parent and having a child. That was one thing. And it's letting that go and finding the new dream. And what is realistic, but what is still, you know, your best potential, your child's best potential. I do some work in my community with at-risk kids. And one of the things that's amazing is realizing sometimes it's just the parents just have to change perspective. Like, the child is going to be great and have a great life, but it won't be the life you had first thought. It's going to be different than that.
But that's always the case. Boy, I'll tell you what, even when the kid goes off to college, you might have one idea for what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And then their reality kicks in. We actually have someone, it looks like, who would like to ask you a question. Lisa, Jeffrey, is that you?
It is, Bill. Thanks so much for taking my question. It's, again, a
my pleasure.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Congratulations on the release of your latest book, Find Her. This will be number 17, or is this 18 now?
Oh, we're back to that question.
Let me get to my question. With all the public acclaim and recognition and financial success that you so justifiably received, really my deeper part of the question is, on the most personal level, what stayed with you throughout the years and that you still love most in the act of simply sitting down and writing a good story?
I think there comes
what keeps
this
you going?
Moment. You ask a great question. When my first book hit the New York Times list, I really got stuck. It's like I sat down every day and it's like, I'm a New York Times bestselling author. And to tell you the truth, the computer screen is still blank and the keyboard is still covered in chocolate and coffee. And the writing process itself never changes. Publishing can bring you success, but that's really thanks to your publisher. The writing process will always be you and the voices in your head, alone in the room. And none of that cares how many copies you've sold. None of them care about, is this book 16, 17, or 18? So I feel like we as writers have to stay in touch with the writing. That's what we do. And some days it's going to really suck. And some days it's going to be better than we thought we could do. And that's what keeps you coming back, because some of those days it really is magic. And the other days I personally eat M&Ms. And
right. Yeah. And I hope my listeners listen to that, because hear that and really take that in, because I've heard this from writers like Lisa and from writers like Andre Dubuis and from Amy Tan, and it is universal. Lisa, as I said, has 22 million books in print. Her books are in 30 countries. She's won awards. She does movies and blah, blah, blah. That's all great. And yet the experience she has, which she just described to you, is the same experience you have, whether you've sold one book or no books or 10 books. It remains the same experience. Although I would think you could let it get into your head. Even the success could get into your head and make you say, well, I got to make sure this one's really good, because.
Yes. And you do have to be careful that you don't try to think in terms of that last book was so good. Now what do I do? You just,
right.
Each story is its own story and you're the guide and you're doing your best. And
right.
There's going to be hits and misses. The other person who's an idol for me as a writer is Stephen King. And I think he's one of the single most talented, proficient writers we've had. But still, he has built a body of work.
Huge.
Some people who can argue, I don't like this book as much as I like
right.
that book, and this book is very different than this book. And he's done fantasy books, and he's done, you know,
yeah.
well, some are psychological and some horror, and he's done this and
right.
he's done that. It's a body of work, and I think of that all the time, too. This individual novel doesn't have to be perfect. I'm going,
right.
as a writer, to create a body of work that later I can look back on with pride.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't have everything hinging on the one perfect story.
Not if you want to sleep at night.
And you want to sleep at night. See, that could be scarier than a killer in the window, the idea that this book has to be perfect. Oh, it's so true. It's so true. And every book, and here's the thing, don't you feel like, Lisa, that even though one book might sell, I'm sure all your books sell pretty well at this point. You've got a really established readership. But for you, you know, some book maybe does a little better than the other one. But don't you always feel like you learned something writing every book, that somehow, regardless of how what the readers think of it, something in you grew as a writer?
Well, and that's even how I plan my books. Like, I was attracted to find her and wanted to write that story because, one, it was about a position in law enforcement I had known nothing about, the FBI's Office of Victim Assistance. But it also, to me, felt like it was turning traditional suspense on its head. The book doesn't start with the kidnapping. It picks up, in fact, after the woman's been rescued and the kidnapper's long gone. And I think doing something different each time, it keeps you fresh as a writer. It keeps you interested. And I have to believe, maybe I am old-fashioned, but I have to believe that shows in the end, in the book. I mean, if it's interesting and fascinating for you when you're writing it, please let it be interesting and fascinating to the reader.
Well, what else can you do? What else have you got but what interests you? Because, I mean, you will never know what interests me, but you will know what interests you. I mean, what else have you got?
Well,
at the
other
end of the
thing,
day?
I often think rather selfishly, and I will admit this, if I have done my job right as a suspense novelist, you're going to read my book in 2 days. I, on the other hand, am going to spend a year crafting it.
Yeah.
So it really, to a certain extent, there has to be something in the story that interests me, or I'm
going
to lose my mind.
That's right. No, it's absolutely true. You got to be interested in the story. It's got to be interesting. Well,
yes.
This has been a wonderful conversation. Lisa, we have time for one more question, which I like to ask all my guests. What I'd like you to do is finish this sentence for me. You ready?
Oh, fun. Okay.
If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me what?
If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me to listen to myself. I think that's the only way you get through a book, is you have to... You can't write a book by committee. You can't be sending it out to critique partners, know how brilliant they are, or editors, or how well-meaning and brilliant they are. At the end of the day, it's you and the story, and you have to listen to yourself and think hard and go with your gut a lot of the time, which is kind of a scary thing. So maybe the second thing writing has taught me is to be really comfortable with fear.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember you said, actually, we interviewed you. We did an interview. I didn't do it. Another woman did it. But we interviewed you for the magazine a bunch of years ago. And you said something I love that I still use when I teach, which is that writers have to be comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
And that's one of those things you, again, when you become successful, you think that part will change. You have
right.
arrived. You know what you're doing. You will never be uncomfortable again. And no, not at all. No, or at least I have not managed to achieve that yet. Let me put it that way.
That's awesome. Well, Lisa, congratulations on book number 18. It's Find Her. For those listening, it'll be out. Let's go with it. It's February 9th. It'll be out everywhere. You can probably pre-order it now on Amazon or wherever. Congrats. And another year, another book. I look forward to reading it, even if it scares me.
Thank you.
Okay, Lisa, take it easy.
Thank you very much, Bill. Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, you got to listen, people. It's true. She said listen to herself, and it's true. And writing isn't thinking, it's listening. It really is. It's just listening. Well, next week, I'm going to be talking to Susan Mallory, another fabulous best-selling writer. Until then, just go write what you love. Write what you're interested in. Write what you're curious about. Ask a question that you're actually interested in finding out the answer to, and that's what you should write. How easy is that?